But for me, it always breaks my heart when I hear people saying, I can't wait for the holiday. I hate Monday mornings.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow. Like, I know so many people I was in radiotherapy with who are no longer alive. They would love a Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that to people, and people say to me, oh, I hate a Monday morning, or, you know, this is rubbish and that. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, and I tell them a story. I'll share a story of, you know, a 30-year-old girl I knew who passed away of cancer. She would love a Monday morning. She would love a commute. You know, if you're on the commute, read a book. There's so much stuff you can do to grow yourself, which then might change your situation.
Welcome back. My guest today is David Smith. He is a two-time world champion and a London 2012 gold medalist. He was also awarded an MBE for his services to rowing in 2013. You might also recognize David from his career in cycling, where he has also represented GB. David has been through some incredible setbacks in his career, which include fighting for his life due to a rare tumor and suffering a spinal cord injury. This is one of the most phenomenal conversations I've ever had on how you push both your mental and physical boundaries and never taking life for granted. It is a phenomenal conversation, and I'm sure it's going to inspire a lot of people. I know it certainly inspired me. I hope you enjoy. Let's go. Right. It is great to have you on the podcast. I'm really, really excited about this conversation that we're about to have, really. I've followed your journey for some time and, you know, putting in a bit of groundwork, really, and researching you more so before this conversation. And, you know, I couldn't get over what you've been through, how you've been through it. So I guess what I'm going to ask you to start with is probably the question you've been asked the most, but it's probably the most complex, which is, how do you become a world champion?
Wow, that is a hard
big one to start with.
That's a hard question. You know, I think anyone you ask will have a slightly different answer, but I think there will be a general theme that runs across that, and it's probably certain characteristics, you know, like perseverance, resilience, you know, some character strengths, and basically that attention to detail, the enjoyment of hard work, discipline. And then I think there's also probably a slight enjoyment of suffering in there as well. I think that there's definitely, I know that through different research papers, there's always been the question asked, you know, world champion, world-class athletes, has there been any trauma somewhere in their life that's driven them into this? You know, what's their motivators? And I think everyone's slightly different, but I think there are those general themes of, you know, being a disciplined person and the enjoyment of hard work, that attention to detail, persistence, that's probably runs through every single athlete. I think every athlete I've met that's sort of been at the top of their game all has that sort of similar mindset, you know. And I think also, which is really important, I think you have to be intrinsically motivated. I think if you're just chasing an external goal, then you're setting yourself up for failure on a few levels. I think if you, there's a great saying in Cool Runnings, you know, if you're not enough without the medal, you won't be enough with it. And I think the start of any athlete's journey, we should actually be developing the human, not the athlete. And I think sometimes in sport, we do get that a little bit wrong. I think Tokyo is an example of that. A lot of athletes starting to speak out, they feel maybe safer to speak out. So I think if you're going to set off to become a world champion, I think the first thing you do is develop the human, you know who you are, what your philosophy is, your purpose, your values, your character strengths. Because ultimately the path to world champion is not straight. Okay, you see all these phenomenal athletes who are world champions, but you don't see all the adversity, the ups and the downs in the background. There's never a straight line to success. And more often it's, you know, I actually think more often the stories of the people who almost made it are sometimes much, much more interesting. But what I see is that if you develop the human first, then when you do win the medal, you're just more humble. You're a whole person. You know, you're less likely to be arrogant because you're not insecure. You're not hiding anything. You're just very much a whole person. And I think if you develop that whole person, I think that's probably the foundation to going on to then pursue that goal and that dream. But I think it's certainly got to come from an intrinsic motivator, not just I want to be a world champion because of I get the likes. It's got to be, I want to be a world champion because this aligns with my values. And I think that's very important. And I think if we're working with youngsters, I think that's a real good lesson to teach them.
And in terms of intrinsic motivation then, have you always had that from that young age? Did you always know when you were young that you wanted to be this athlete?
For me, sport was never really about winning to start with. Again, it was just a way of life. You know, I started off doing lots of sports. Karate was a big sport of mine. And again, it was never really about the outcome goal. It was all about getting into the the process goals, the performance goals. Okay, you wanted to become a black belt. That was obviously the end goal, but it wasn't really about that. You really focused the Japanese sort of methodology was really, let's build a strong foundation. And it taught you to be present and stay in the moment. And I think the danger with sometimes Olympic sport is it actually pulls you out of the moment. And you're always thinking of the next Olympics as that's what's linked to funding, to medals. Mm. And sometimes you do miss out on the process and staying present. So I think for me, I never really wanted to be a world champion. I just loved sport. And I struggled academically. I didn't really have the attention. I grew up in the Highlands of Scotland. There was this great outdoors to be explored. And, you know, my parents just threw me into every single sport. And I think I wanted to win. I played a sport called shinty, which is a Gaelic sport. So it's like hurling and ice hockey. And of course, every time I took the pitch, I wanted to win. So I think it was definitely in there from a young age. The motivation behind that, I'm not entirely sure what it was at that age, but I wouldn't say that I had this vision of wanting to go to the Olympics or be a world championship or anything. I just think anything I did, it was more, I think for me, it was more winning myself. If I went to run, it was like, okay, how far can David run? How far can David go? It wasn't about like, I want to beat everybody. It was more around like, what can I do as my best performance? And wherever that took me in a completely different path. And actually, I think for me, all the lessons I learned in sport from a young age, through losses, through defeats, through injury, through success, actually prepared me to deal with a bigger battle. And that was fighting for my life, which was, you know, later on in my story. But I think the lessons from sport actually transcended sport.
Do you think then that is almost, it would be the basic answer, but the key to success is enjoying what you're doing rather than looking at all these tangible things? Because I think far too many people look at the tangible reward. Oh, they're this fantastic person. They've won this, they've done that. But it's more to do with what you enjoy, because you've done it in, I think, three different sports. You're a champion in three different sports. Is it just all about just enjoying the process rather than just looking at that end goal wholeheartedly and just going towards it?
I think it's the difference between human being and human doing. And I think it's really easy to become human doing. And for me, I had to go through 6 surgeries, 4 diagnoses of cancer, paralysis and everything to learn this. It didn't just come to me. And I realized when I was lying in hospital, you know, the last time in 2018, where I genuinely thought, I closed my eyes and I thought I was going to die. I wasn't sure. I didn't even know if I was going to open them. I was in so much pain. But I remember thinking that when we're in that point fighting for our life, medals are irrelevant. Titles are irrelevant. Like plasma TVs, TV, all this stuff is irrelevant. All you really have is memories, and memories are made from savor and experiences. Yeah. So if you're doing something you genuinely don't like just to get a medal, I think you've got to ask yourself, is this right for me? And, you know, a lot of people get into sport because for so many different reasons. Sometimes it's just because they're good at it. And then they end up in a system, they come through a system and they just find, look, I'm really good at this, but I actually don't really enjoy it. Mm. And then I think you've got to have an honest conversation with yourself then. And maybe that's, you know, maybe we're not fully conscious. And then I ask myself, you know, who am I winning medals for? Am I winning medals for the national body, or am I winning medals because I want to win medals? Am I happy with just making the start line? So I asked all these questions to myself, and I realized that ultimately you've got to enjoy it. And I've spoke to some athletes in the sports I've been involved over the years, and they didn't enjoy it. And I'm thinking, well, what's the point? Like, we only get one life. And I know everyone kind of says that all the time. And it's a little bit of a corny thing to say that, you know, we're only here once. We don't have a trial here. It's the real performance. But it's so true, and it goes so quickly, it's pretty scary. And I think that you've got to find something you enjoy, and then you embrace it. And ultimately, I always say to one of my friends who's a ski coach, happy athletes are fast athletes. You know, like, why create a system that A, maybe makes people unhappy? Or if you're unhappy as the athlete, then I think you've got to be honest with yourself, step back and say, look, this is not really for me. And Tom Dumoulin did it this year in cycling. You know, he took time away from the sport. came back and got on the podium at the Olympic time trial. And if he hadn't taken time away, he probably wouldn't have made the podium. So I think it's a mature decision sometimes to say, no, I'm going to step back and just see what life is all about. I think you can get very sucked into a tunnel that's all about performance results, and it's just repeat. Mm. And you miss out on the process. And I think that's the one thing I learned from all the time I've been in hospital, living years now in an ICU. You know, there's not one person with their dying breath who said to me that they wish they'd been more focused on their performances. They all say to me, I wish I'd done more stuff that really enriched me and loved. And I think that goes back to developing the human before the athlete. Because if you purely develop athlete, then some athletes don't know who they are. Where if you develop the human first, then it gives the athlete a little bit of an autonomy about who they are as a person. And then they can make a bit more of these decisions and say, well, actually, you know what? Okay, I thought I was this person. I thought I wanted that, but actually I don't. And that's okay.
They don't feel lost then when they might have to retire or they get an injury. They don't think, well, what am I? I like that. So can you talk to me a little bit about the adversity you face with your, you know, illnesses and your injuries?
Yeah. So, I was born with club foot, which is telepsis. So both my feet were sort of fused backwards and they were repeatedly rebroken, set in plaster casts as a baby. There's a high chance I was also born with a genetic tumor, which sits in my spinal cord, at C3, C4, so in the neck, and that compresses all the nerves. So that controls the nerves to basically everything under here, lungs, bladder, bowel, sexual function, legs, everything. So I had a lot of convulsions as a young baby, and I was misdiagnosed as having epilepsy. I was put on epileptic medication for probably about 10 years, which for sure would have had, you know, a neurological impact on my neurological development, which was probably seen in my schooling. I struggled massively there. And the trauma of my feet as well at such a young age, I can't remember that, but as the brain is developing, for sure there's going to be trauma installed there. I went through my whole life in excruciating pain, fatigue, but I could never differentiate between the pain of sport and the pain of tumor, because I didn't know I had a tumor. And I just thought I was tired all the time. I'd go to doctors, I'd go to medical practice, and they'd say, look, you're doing too much sport. And there was always a sort of a reasonable answer for all the pain I was in. And it wasn't until I think I was about 31, 32. It was 2010, and I was suffering from huge amounts of pain. I was having electric shocks in my wrists. I couldn't feel things in my hands. It was like I was slowly losing my body. It felt almost like I was trapped in some sort of movie. And I couldn't sleep. I was going to the bathroom about 30 times a day. So then when I went to my performances start to drop, I was at GB Row, and they start to investigate why the performances were dropping. They send you for a series of tests. And it's like box ticking. Okay, if you're going to the toilet 30 times a day, let's investigate your bladder. Let's investigate your bowel, which they're absolutely excruciatingly horrible tests. You know, cameras stuck up into your bladder. It was a horrible experience to go through, especially so young. I was the youngest guy in the waiting room by about 30, 40 years. And so it was this point where the question started to get asked, you know, what's going on here? And eventually they sent me for an MRI scan, and that found the tumor. And the first surgery, they had to cut through the front of my neck, remove parts of vertebrae, go into the spinal cord. And ultimately, what I kind of thought, that was 2 years before the London Games, and then my whole focus was to get to London. What I thought was going to be just not a simple thing, but I kind of just thought that, well, this is it. I've had my tumor, put me back together. I suffered a stroke, a blood clot and a stroke, and almost died after the first surgery. Spent a month in hospital. I spent 4 or 5 months in rehabilitation. Within 6 months, I was back in a rowing boat. And I got to London and then crossed that finish line and was like, well, that's it. I'm shutting that book. I don't ever want to go through that again. But what I didn't actually realize at that point is that was going to be the first surgery of 6. And actually, where a lot of athletes were chasing Olympics and chasing medals, my real race became with life. And that just went on to have multiple diagnoses of tumors, cut through the front of the neck, I think, 3-4 times, down through the back of the neck to the side of the back of the neck. And in 2016, I went in, I was diagnosed. I was pretty much as quick as they were having surgeries, I was re-diagnosed. So I'd get through all the rehabilitation, I'd learn to walk again, I'd get back into sport, I'd race for Britain, and within a month I'd be diagnosed again. So it was absolutely heartbreaking to put all that work in to get to a start line, to then have all these targets. So on one side, I had performance sport telling me, right, you've got to hit X, Y, and Z. And then on the other side, I've got doctors saying to me, well, your tumor's coming back, you might die. So I was trying to balance these two, like almost these two identities. And I was getting drawn from patient to athlete, patient to athlete. And that's when I realized, I was like, well, who am I in amongst all this? I'm neither a patient or an athlete. And that's when I started to do a lot of the inner work. And I think that was a savior. So the paradox for me is that being diagnosed four times and having six spinal surgeries, it's actually made me conscious of life. Mm-hmm. And I've always kind of lived by the philosophy that I'm not scared to die. I'm more scared of not to live. And this has actually shown me to live. It took a lot, but it's given me an idea of how precious life is.
What did the doctor say to you? Did they advise you not to continue with sport?
Not at all. Not at all. There's no link to sport, to the tumor. I've never, you know, for the first block of surgeries, it was basically diagnosis to surgery. Then in 2016, I walked in, I was fully fit. I had no symptoms, had a surgery. I woke up and I've never moved again. So I've completely lost my left arm. I've lost my left leg. I lost function to my left lung. And I remember opening my eyes in ICU and thinking, I can't move. And this is not like previous where it was like a temporary paralysis. I thought, this is completely different. And the doctor was like, you will move, don't worry about it. And when I sat there, I remember looking at the ICU doctor and I was like, right, I've got two goals from this bed. One is to ride for Great Britain again, and the other is to cycle across the Alps. And that's going to be my drive and motivation. That's what's going to push me every day to try and rehab. Because when you're lying paralyzed from the neck down in a bed, you need goals. Goals are important. Yeah. And you need something to really hold on. It'd be very easy just to almost just switch off from life. And, you know, the doctors were all very much behind that. They were like, you know, whatever's going to push you. And obviously the great thing with being an athlete is you're constantly getting monitored. So actually what was kind of frustrating for me is that my bloods, my resting heart rate's 36 to 38 beats a minute. My heart rate variability is great. My bloods are great. On the surface, I present as this super healthy 43-year-old guy, but I have this mass grown in my spinal cord, which is just wreaking havoc with my body. But the doctors were all very much about, right, if you want to live. And that's the thing with, you know, with living, is that the paralysis is taking away the best part of my best parts of my life and my years. I'm going to be paralyzed now to the day I die. And that's a seriously hard thing to live with. And it's a constant reminder. So I've gone from having a tumor to now also having a spinal cord injury. So it's like I'm managing these two conditions. And I just realized that it's so important to do what really enriches me. And the thing with sport is when I do sport, it's like I disconnect from everything and my brain just goes offline and I'm just in the moment and I leave my disability. I was out riding this morning at 5:30 a.m. And as soon as I got on my bike, it's a real faff to get on my bike because I'm obviously paralyzed. But when I got on my bike and ride, I leave my disability behind. I leave cancer behind. And for those moments on the bike, I'm free. So it's not about trying to win races. It's just about trying to live. And thankfully, everyone in my medical team has always been really supportive of that.
That's phenomenal how you can go from all those setbacks to then having such a positive outlook on life. So for you, from being through all of that then, but still accomplishing the goals that you want to accomplish, what's your definition of success to you?
Making the start line. Literally, you know, and living by my values and my philosophy. I think that is my success. Now there's still a part of me in me that's the athlete program from 20 years in the system. It's like, no, I must win medals, I must do this. And for me, I've got to be consciously aware of that. So I catch those thoughts, I observe them, and I'm like, okay, do those thoughts really serve me? Who am I doing that for? Who's the medal for? Okay, where am I really most happiest? And that's either swimming in the open water or on my bike. Do I need to be a world champion for that? No, I don't. Do I need to be on the national team? No, I don't. I can still race. I can still compete. So for me, for success is ultimately, I think personally, is living by your values and what your philosophy is and being true to yourself. And if that's making the start line, that's fantastic. And I think for me as well, coming through all of this, I just try to live with compassion and not judgment. You know, humans are so quick to judge before they know the story of another human. You see it, everyone's running around, you know, angry and aggressive. And yeah. I think, you know, the more compassion there is in the world, that's success. And I think that, you know, it's great to chase medals. It's a very self-centered thing. For me now, especially now, I often think, you know, if I can have an effect on someone else's life, that's way more powerful than any medal. The medal sometimes allows and creates a platform to do that. And I recognize that. But actually, if you can have an influence on somebody's life and change it, then that to me is much more powerful. And for me, if someone messages me and says, hey, look, you've given me the strength to keep going, that is far more than a medal for me now.
Wow. It's who you inspire along the way, isn't it? That's the most important thing. I love that. So for those people who are listening now and they're inspired, they're perhaps maybe in a place where they're up against it. I don't know. They might be going through an illness. It could be an injury, maybe mental health, or just lacking motivation, perhaps. What are the three habits perhaps that you live by to make sure that you're living more purposely and you're getting the best out of yourself and you're enjoying life?
Yeah, I think the first one is compassion to yourself and others. I think, you know, not being hard on yourself. One thing everyone always says to me with cancer is, oh, just be positive, be positive. And that's like the worst thing you can say, because then it's almost saying that it's not okay to be negative. I think it's basically having the self-awareness. This is something I really try to do, is be self-aware of all my emotions, all my feelings, all my thoughts, how they make me feel. You know, and if I wake up one day and I just feel pretty rubbish, I'm okay with that. I'm like, you know what? Okay, this is not forever. Let's just ride this out. Let's see what it is. If I need to talk to somebody, if, you know, what do I need that day? Maybe I need to pick up the phone and speak to a psychologist, or maybe I just need to speak to a friend. What I've found is that the more self-aware I am of myself and peeling back the layers of the onion, the better I can manage that. And it's almost been okay. Like, everyone says it's okay to not be okay, but do people really know what that means? You know, is it just a fashionable thing to post on all the social media things, or do people actually action it? And I think that most people who maybe post that don't really know what that actually means. And they're just like, well, I'll just jump on the bandwagon and do that as well. And I think for me, it's actually knowing that it's being okay with who you are and connecting to that. But that takes a lot of work. This is not something that we can have instantly. So for me, the biggest thing is I disconnect from this. This is a killer. This pulls your attention. It teaches you to detrain. It pulls you away from self-awareness. So I spend time just with my journal, writing about my thoughts. You know, why did I think that today? And I don't share that with anyone. That's just for me. And it helps me grow as a person. It helps me grow as a human. If I react poorly to something throughout the day, I'll address that in the evening. And I just want to be a better person each day I wake up. How can I be a better human? So my first habit is self-awareness. And that's a big one, and really understanding all the stuff that goes on. And also understanding that Andrew Huberman from Stanford talks a lot about this sort of thoughts, feelings, emotions, and behaviors. And he always tries to say, don't go that way. Start with behaviors, and that is easy, and it influences everything. So I'm very aware that if I get out into nature, do sport, then for sure I'm going to feel better. So that self-awareness about you as a person, I think, is the biggest one. The second habit I did is learn how to breathe. Breathing is at the foundation of everything. And it's actually spoke a lot now after James Nestor's book, Breathe. You know, Patrick McEwan's done a lot of work. Brian McKenzie does a lot of work in the breath space. And Andrew Huberman as well talks a lot about breath stuff and how we can control our autonomic nervous system. And what I've realized since I've learned how to breathe, I have better control over my emotional regulation. I'm more connected to my body. So it almost works hand in hand with self-awareness. So it might sound stupid to learn how to breathe, but the first thing we do as humans is breathe. And the last thing we ever do is breathe is an exhale. So we start life on an inhale, we end on an exhale, and it's something we're not mindful of the rest of the time. So I think learning how to breathe is a great one. And as also, I think it's one of the fastest ways to take you out of your mind and into your body. So I think that is pretty important. And my third habit is learning. You know, like literally the day you think you know it all, then what's the point in getting up? I think it's, you know, enriching yourself, learning about them, becoming a student of your mind, your body, you know, learning your craft, you know, doing the work physically in the body. The whole time I was in hospital, the majority of people I seen in ICU was between the 40 and 60 who were CEOs who were just do. And, you know, they didn't know how to eat. They didn't know how to sleep. They didn't know how to manage their bodies. So, you know, just investing a little bit in that learning. And it's not going and doing a PhD in psychology, but it's maybe choosing, you know, good podcasts that enrich you, books that enrich you, books that challenge you, and ultimately explore your beliefs. So I think learning, they're my three sort of takeaways from 11 years in hospital that I've sort of learned and I try to install every day.
And that encompasses it all, doesn't it? The learning to understand your thoughts and feelings, and that you're going to have certain thoughts. They're going to be good, they're going to be bad, but that's okay, isn't it? And just knowing what to do with it. And I like what you said about the breathing there. That's something I do regularly ever since I read this book last year. I think it was the Wim Hof one. And it was Andrew Huberman as well. Him, I listened to him on a podcast, and I'm hooked on his podcasts. And it's just, you know, when you're feeling anxious or you're feeling overwhelmed, it's just slowing everything down. And I think that's so important. I think we get caught up, don't we, in a world that's going so, so quick at the moment. And I like what you said before, again, with your phone, like switching off from your phone. That's something I'm trying to do a lot more, because you look on there and it's a highlight reel. Everyone is trying to be busy. Everyone is trying to be the most productive. And you think, well, actually, that's not the winning way, is it? I think the best thing you can do is just take a step back and just realize, actually, there are other things to learn. There are more smarter ways to do things, and just calm things down, isn't it?
Slow it down, you know, and I think in a world where we're more connected now, it's impossible to disconnect and connect to your body. And we're actually less disconnected. You know, the crazy thing for me is I go out riding my bike, and the majority of people I see riding their bikes like this are out running, and they can't, they're so addicted to it. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, like, you need to connect to nature. It's so important to connect to nature. And this one opportunity you have, go out for an hour, 90 minutes of uninterrupted exercise in the morning, turn it off. You know, if you have to listen to music, fair, that's okay. But, you know, you shouldn't be scrolling when you're out connecting with nature. You know, look at things around you, really absorb it. And yeah, exactly what you said. If you can breathe, it just slows everything down, and it gives you time to not be more reactive, to be a bit more responsive. And ultimately, it looks after your whole mental and the whole being as a human. But I think that, I don't know, I think nowadays, you know, people are looking for this quick fix, and the breathing is almost too simple. It's like, it can't be that simple.
But it is so simple. You know, the little things, you know, I did a post the other day about just living simply. And one of them for me is my go-to is just have a really cold shower in the morning and just focus on my breathing. You know, I don't sit and meditate or anything, but I'll go in a cold shower and I'll focus on my breathing, and it just slows everything down. And you feel set for the day then, you know, and it reminds me, right, you know, you can't do this at a million miles an hour, because it's only going to lead to burnout.
Yeah. And I think also what it does is that it doesn't give you a chance to savor moments. Mm. And then, you know, we're all going to die. This is a given, you know, unless somebody works out how we're going to live forever, but we're going to die. And I often think, you know, I've lay on that deathbed so many times now. And I remember lying in anesthetics thinking, wow, you know, if this is the last thing I ever see, you know, this is not a great place to be. And it made me question a lot. And when I was in human doing mode, I wasn't savoring moments. You know, I have all these great memories. I look back at photographs and I'm like, you know, was I just trying to live to the next thing? You know, was I trying to get to the next race, trying to get to this next target? Okay, I've got to reach these targets. And ultimately, you get to the end of it and you're burnt out. You didn't really savor the moments. And, you know, you're a bit of a mental wreck at the end of it all. And I kind of thought, that's not life. And it's not meaning that you don't have goals. You've got to have goals. They drive you forward. But it's been able to be in the moment and be present. And I think that's what breathing really does. I love that start. That's how I start my morning as well. You know, is get in the shower, do the cold shower. It helps you regulate your breathing. And ultimately, it brings you to live where your feet are. And then, like you say, it sets you up for the rest of the day. So the rest of the day, you're more conscious about everything you do. You're aware. And in a way, that's the blessing of a spinal cord injury as well, when you can still walk. Because I'm an incomplete, so I can still walk. But every step I take has got to be 100% conscious. Now, if not, I fall over. So I can't walk along the street on my phone, because I've got one arm in this and I've got one arm in a walking stick. So... Yeah. I can't. And it's actually one of the greatest things, because now when I actually go out, I hear every noise of the birds. I notice everything. I notice people. And it's amazing the amount of people who walk on the street and bump into me because they don't see me, because they're just not there. And I'm thinking, wow, actually, it's crazy that a spinal cord injury, which is one of the worst things that can happen to a human, can actually make you much more conscious, because everything you do has got to be more conscious. And I always say to people, you know, if you're struggling with this, just if you're brushing your teeth in the morning, be fully present in that process. You know, just don't be just doing it as an action and then, you know, getting out the door as quickly as you can. Actually start to be a bit more present. And everyone always says, I don't have time to meditate. I don't have time to do this. There's 24 hours in the day. We have time to do, we have time to invest in yourself. If you don't invest in yourself, then you're going to have a long list of hospital things that you're going to have to take care of later in life.
You know, this reminds me of what a lot of people say, where they're like, I can't wait for the weekend. I can't wait for the weekend. I can't wait for the holiday. And it's like, they're not living Monday to Friday. It's like, they're just living for the weekend. I'll do some self-care then. It's an everyday thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an everyday thing. And imagine being, you know, obviously, yeah, okay, Maslow's needs, survival was the first one. People need to put a roof over their head. People need to do this. I completely understand that. And you might be in a situation where I am living for the weekend. But if you have any influence over that, you can always breathe, you can always meditate, and you can always do the work, the inner work, and you might learn to create some form of balance and some form of sort of appreciation and self-actualization. Even if you're in a job that you don't love at the moment, it might be a step out of that. But if you don't do the work, then you're never going to step out of that. But for me, it always breaks my heart when I hear people saying, I can't wait for the holiday. I hate Monday mornings.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow. Like, I know so many people I was in radiotherapy with who are no longer alive. They would love a Monday morning. And I say that to people, and people say to me, oh, I hate a Monday morning, or, you know, this is rubbish and that. And I'm thinking, wow, you know. And I tell them a story. I'll share a story of, you know, a 30-year-old girl I knew who passed away of cancer. She would love a Monday morning. She would love a commute. You know, if you're on the commute, read a book. There's so much stuff you can do to grow yourself, which then might change your situation. And I think that's really important. And I sometimes get caught up in that as well. I'll be, oh, it's raining again today. Oh, I'm stuck in central London and riding my bike. And I've got to pull myself out of that and say, well, actually, you know what? When I was lying in ICU and I couldn't walk, I would give anything to ride my bike in Hyde Park. But all of a sudden, Hyde Park's not good enough for me. So, you know, because we're all human. Yeah. We're all going to be pulled back to this base level of beliefs and programming that we've had for so many years. So I think that's why it's important to always do the work, because if you stop doing the work, then you get pulled.
Absolutely. So you spoke before about, you know, some of the achievements that you've had, and you look back at photos and you think, you know, they're wonderful memories. But at the time, I was just focusing on almost on the end product and being this champion. What are some of your most profound experiences, do you think, that have allowed you to almost be this version of yourself now, to live more purposefully?
I would love to say they've come from sport, but I would be lying. I think that sport gave me the toolkit to deal with the hospital stuff, but the hospital gave me an insight and a toolkit to be able to live.
Yeah.
So I think where all of those lessons I learned as a kid, where it was, you know, not winning the school race and getting knocked down and told you, oh, you're never going to achieve all that, they were all great lessons. I think every lesson is so important, whether it's a failure or a success, there's always a lesson to be learned. But ultimately, what really drove me to learn and this hunger to understand the brain came from hospital. It came from not my first surgery, more probably my third surgery, because I spent almost six, seven months in hospital. I was in a high dependence neurological ward for 8 weeks. So I seen everything. I seen, you know, a really fit guy being brought in, told he had motor neuron disease. He probably had a year or two left. They pull the curtain back and he's looking right at me. And I'm like, oh man, I'm so sorry. And you know, see, then the guy in the bed next to me, you have a brain tumor. You're probably not going to live more than 6 months. They pull the curtain back. I'm the first person he sees. So I was starting to have all these interactions with these people. And then from there, I got transferred to Stoke Mandeville, which is a spinal hospital. And then all of a sudden I was gone from a high neurological ward where there were strokes, brain tumors, MND, to then into a spinal cord hospital with 150 spinal cord patients, people who were paralyzed from the neck down, from, you know, a slip on the floor. There was a guy in there who'd fallen out his chute didn't open in the airplane, and he hit the ground from 1,000 feet and broke every bone in his neck. You know, he was an RAF PTI who was now being spoon-fed. There was just huge, like, people in huge traumatic situations. They woke up like any other person who's listening to this today, And then by the evening, they were in Stoke Mandeville with a spinal cord injury. It's, I think every 4 hours, there's one person in the UK who has a spinal cord injury, and it changes someone's life overnight. So all of a sudden you're in this place where people are trapped in a body they don't want. You're a prisoner of your body. You've got to come to terms with that. You've got to learn to accept it. There's all these people around you telling you, you will never walk again. You will never do this again. And that's all you're hearing. There's never anyone saying, you know what, there's a chance you might move. That you don't hear those words. There's no hope. So it's very much just this bad news constantly. So it really, the environment is really, really tough. Now, some people love it. For me, I hated it on a personal level, but it really started to make me start to sort of be curious about why we are the way we are. Only the other day, I tried to help somebody when they went through a red light on their bike. I said, hey, man, you know, don't like, and what I was going to try and explain to him about the risks of doing that in Stoke Mandeville. And before I could even say anything, he started shouting at me and abusing me and telling me to leave him alone and mind my own business. And actually, all I was going to say to him was, hey, I've spent a long time in a spinal cord hospital. If you jump ahead, because he's in human doing mode, he wants to be where he needs to be at work. He's late. I need to get there. Yeah. Boom, hit, paralyzed. Rest of your life in a wheelchair. Rest of your life having somebody wipe your bottom. You know, my highlight of my day in hospital was somebody manually opening my bowels and then giving me a bed bath. Wow. So that is an horrendous experience to think, okay, my whole life is going to be like this. So through that, you know, Viktor Frankl and Nietzsche both say, if you know your why, you can withstand any how, but you've really got to understand that to live is to suffer. That is a real test of suffering. And through there, you have to find purpose. You have to, if you don't, then you will never live again. And you can live a great life with a spinal cord injury. Don't get me wrong. I live a very fulfilling life. And all the friends that I know who are paralyzed live great lives. I've got amazing friends who are in wheelchairs and do incredible things away from Paralympic sport. But you got to do the work. You've got to find that purpose again. And you've almost, it's like you're at the bottom of the sewage pile and you've got to drag yourself through all this thick, horrible sewage to get to the lake and swim in the crystal water. And that's the same with any human. Anything you want to do, there's friction. You've got to go through all the crap before you get to the nice, clear water. But when you get there, it's really worth it. And sometimes people just never get there because the work is too much. The pain is too much. And that's where, when I was in hospital and I realized, I was like, right, how do I find meaning in my life? And I got taken to the first goal planning meeting and they said to me, you know, what's your goals? And I said, well, I want to ride for Great Britain and I want to cycle across the Alps. And the nurse was like, let's just try and brush your teeth and have a shower on your own.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, I must be in a really bad way.
Yeah. So how did it get from that then to going to the Alps? And
so I got out of hospital in 2017. I hit rock bottom. I wanted to commit suicide. I didn't want to live anymore because I'd lost my purpose. And the reason that was is because I transferred from a rehabilitation environment back into a civilian environment. So for the first time, I was dealing with being disabled. And that was really challenging. And, you know, people would push me over. I'd fall over in the street. I was pooing myself. I was peeing myself. You know, can I get to your bathroom? No, you can't use our bathroom. You're not a customer. And then I would have a bowel movement. So these were really horrible things. I'd have to walk and physically put my finger in my bum to stop it coming out. So I'm dealing with all this stuff and people are staring at me. People are not compassionate. They're judging me. And it was a horrible place to be. And I just didn't want to live anymore. And at that point, I reached back out to cycling and said, actually, you know what? I can get back on a bike. I'll just learn how to do it again. And so I did. I made it to the World Championships. And then straight after the World Championships, I was re-diagnosed again. So as quick as that tumor got taken out. So then my psychology went, you didn't have to paralyze me. You went for a full removal of a tumor in the spinal cord and paralyzed me for life. I had just learned to accept the paralysis if I was tumor-free, but now I'm not tumor-free. So what you should have done was only taken a little bit of it and not paralyzed me. because I'm fit enough and strong enough to go through the surgeries. But now I'm living with paralysis as well, because you made a choice when you operated on me and you paralyzed me. So then I had to deal with that. So all of a sudden I was like, I'm facing surgery again. And I thought the only thing I've not done is cycle the Alps. So I did the World Championships, and then I thought I need to go to the Alps. So I jumped on a plane, I flew to Geneva, and in 7 days I cycled 740 kilometers across the Alps to finish in just outside Monaco. And I remember finishing that ride, and the guy who took me on the ride, he was really curious. And I said, well, I'm only cycling with one arm and one leg, but I also have a tumor that's crushing my whole spinal cord. And he was like, I don't think he could quite get it in his head. And I came home and I spoke to a doctor in the Mayo Clinic, because I was trying to find a new surgeon. And he said, can you send me a photo of you standing? I'm looking at your scan. So I sent him a photo of me on my bike at the top of one of the climbs in just outside Monaco. And he's like, no, I need a recent picture. I said, that was just last week. And he's wow. he's like, what? And I said, yeah, I just cycled 740 kilometers. Now there'll be a bit of psychology in there. There's a bit of mental stuff there for sure. And also there's a lot of luck, because the tumor had obviously, the way it had positioned itself, it obviously gave me enough room in my cord that I could do that. And then there was just this sheer, I want to do it, because I realized that from the paralysis from 2016, I realized going in for another surgery, I might not live.
Yeah.
There's a high chance to die, and I might never ride a bike again. So the last thing I want to do is do this ride and be really present, enjoy it and love it. And then I went through another two surgeries in November 2018. I saw the dream of going to Tokyo disappear. And then in 2019, I had 6.5 weeks of radiotherapy every day. And since then, my tumor is not causing me any problems.
Good.
So I have this like green card at life, which is a really scary place to be when you've been diagnosed constantly for 11 years. You're all of a sudden given this green pass. And it's really scary, because you're like, do I make goals? Do I not make goals? Do I? So the emotional roller coaster now is probably worse than it's ever been.
Wow. So what is next then?
Just to live.
Just to live. So, yeah.
Try and live and tend to, I want to race next year. I want to race.
You do.
And I I'm training sort of 10 hours a week on the bike if I can. I'm trying to get fit again. So next year, I genuinely want to race. I want to be on the start line at World Cups, national championships, and enjoy it. I don't care if I come last or first or whatever it is. I just want to race, because that's what I love to do. And you know, if ultimately clear scans, that's the huge lesson. And when I get caught up in the human doing a bit much, I do sit and say, wait a minute. Okay, let's just take a little bit of a reflection and think, okay, you've got this green pass at the moment. Don't get caught up in all of the noise and all the rubbish that's out there. Just really focus about staying in the moment, living as a good human being, and not getting, you know, not letting the ego run the show, but actually trying to manage your own ego. And I think that's when I step out the door every morning, I try to say that to myself, okay, me and my ego are stepping out the door. There's another million people in the city or whatever.
Yeah.
All their egos are out as well, but they might not know it. So if you come across people who are angry or who the dude on the bike there, they just to kind of let it go and be like, you know what? That is what it is.
Small things to life. The question I want to ask now, and it alludes to something that you said at the beginning, is that intrinsic motivation, and sometimes you've got to use what you've been through to propel you forward and inspire you. So I guess my question is, the biggest inspiration you've had, is it actually the darkest things that you've been through? Because I've recently read two books, and it was by by Michael Jordan, I think it's his trainer. They're called Relentless and Winning. And he believes that in order to have almost that winning mindset and take you forward in life, you've almost got to have that element of darkness. And it's not a darkness that most people think it is, that it's a really negative thing. It's a darkness that propels you forward, and it's intrinsic. You've got everything that you've been through, the trauma, the illness. Is that actually the biggest inspiration that you have to be the best version of yourself now?
Yeah, great question. I think there's a huge difference between inspiration and in moving you. I think as a kid, And people can inspire you all the time. Like, there'll be so many people inspired from the Olympics that have just happened and the Paralympics are coming. Everyone's like, I'm so inspired. These people are inspirational. That's great. But inspiration's fleeting. Inspiration's not enough to incite change. You have to be moved to be changed. And I love the way it comes from an internal darkness. And I think that's probably true. If you ask every athlete, for sure at some point they've been inspired by another athlete. They've seen it on TV and thought, wow, I want to be that. But then the stuff that really drives them is stuff that's deep down to them. It's linked to their beliefs, their upbringing, any trauma they've had in their life, or, you know, it's that darkness in there. That, and I think if, as long as you can control that and use it, and that it's almost turning it into a positive, I think that's okay. It is what it is. You use what you have to make the best. But again, I think it goes back to, we must develop the human, not just the athlete. And then we can actually start to manage that, rather than that darkness managing you. I think you have to manage the darkness. So for me, my biggest motivation is what I've seen in hospital. It's actually seeing people die. It's also having my eyes closed thinking, I just want to die now. That for me is like a constant reminder to live. And that is dark. And I could, if I don't manage that, that could easily drive me into a real state of depression. It could really alter my states. So I've got to be really mindful of that and be like, right, okay, I can get a lot from this darkness, but I need to be in control of this. And ultimately, I'm the driver of my car. I need to be managing everything that's going on in here. And that takes a lot of work. And I think it's that, you know, I'm a great believer that everyone should be in therapy. Like, I honestly, I think that people scun away from this. And I think it's the difference between sports psychology and clinical psychiatry and clinical psychology. I think there's a place for everything. Sports psychology is great at getting people to perform at a high level, but is it necessarily the right approach when you're dealing clinically with a clinical issue? And all athletes are humans first and foremost. So there will be some clinical issues there that maybe need addressed. And it's okay, how do we bring clinical psychology and psychiatry into sports? Steve Peters was a great example of that. He ain't a sports psychologist, but yet his influence within British cycling, his influence with all the athletes he's worked with has been amazing, because he's bringing a whole approach to it, not just purely sports psychology. So I think that what we need to realize is that we are working with humans, and to get the most out of them, to make sure that they're managing that darkness and that darkness is not overclouding them and running them, I think then that's a little bit dangerous. Because okay, you might win medals, but what's the fallout at the end? And only this week we've seen a New Zealand track cyclist take her life at the age of 24.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that's where big questions must be asked, and not have all the success of the medals overshadow what could be an actual underlying problem. And I think that's where there's a definite role for sport to develop the humans at a very young, this has to happen at a young age. This has to happen at grassroots level. And I think then we should make this big shift, and we'll still have winners. We'll still have great people, but what we won't have, we'll have less of athletes who are really struggling mentally to the point where they actually do take their own life. I think that's a serious red flag. About the darkness maybe managing them rather than them managing the darkness. Because I think athletes are a slightly different breed. So I think when you realize as a performance team, when you have an athlete in your care, they're in your care. There's a duty of care. They're in your care. And you've got to know that this person might be so intrinsically driven from something so, so dark that they're never going to tell you about. You don't know that. You've only seen them when they've come onto the program, but you don't know their full history. And I think that's something that needs to be considered and taken into account, and not just spoke about, but actually, you know, having clinical psychiatrists who are on the list that an athlete knows, actually, you know, I can go and speak to this person that's away from the program. And I think that is okay to do. And I think, you know what, the only thing I said to that guy who shouted at me in the bike, I was like, you need to see a psych. That was it. You know, people need to do the inner work. People don't. And Michael Gervais talks about it. You train three things. You train your physiology, your psychology, and your craft. We're always training the body and training our craft, but we forget to train our minds. And what, just let this run away in its own.
And it's more telling now, isn't it? After everything everyone's been through, everyone's just back in a rush. And it's almost like it's more aggression in the world than you think, right, really, you know? But
well, that's, I think that's what a lot of people said. A lot of people said, well, people come out of this better. And I said right at the start, no. Because some people will, but the majority of people won't, because the majority of people don't understand all this stuff. They don't understand about what it is when you go through trauma, the stages of trauma, the denial, the aggression, the badgering, the depression. They won't understand that. And the whole world went through that. And it's almost like being paralyzed. And you've basically got all these people now that are on the other side of that. And they've been caged up. We don't know their stories. We don't know their home stories. And they're now running around angry and aggressive. And and I often thought, you know, everyone was like, oh, maybe everyone will come out more compassionate. And I said, no, we probably won't. People will come out angry and judgmental, and they'll hold grudges, and they'll be just exasperated in such a rush. And that's why I think that, you know, we should be teaching this stuff in primary school, not even thinking about athletes. This should be a whole human.
I agree. And that's something that I do. I'm a teacher. So and one of the things that I make sure I try and instill in my students is living more compassionately and articulating their feelings. It's a really great thing here in Wales that we've got a new curriculum coming in, and it's a massive, massive thing on well-being now. So it's getting kids to understand their feelings a little bit more and acting compassionately, you know, and it's the little things, you know. I say to them, whenever they're walking out, could be with their parents, could be with whoever, walk with your head up, never look down, don't look at your phone, smile at someone, say hello, you know, because those things mean so much to people. And I think that's almost like a lost thing now, that people are always on their phone, they're looking down, you know, and it's like, that's such a shame.
You're missing the real beauty of the world. And you know, the greatest gift we've been given is our health and the planet. I don't understand why we need to go elsewhere. And of course, the knowledge in these things is amazing. We can have, you know, social media, I think, is a great thing if it's used correctly.
Yeah.
And used wisely. And I think that's great. You know, you've got teachers like yourself who know this and you can understand this. And then the impact you have on all of these kids' lives is huge. And you might never see it, but these kids might go on, you don't know what they're going to go on and develop. And they might always remember, oh yeah, my teacher, you know, taught me this and taught me to be more mindful and aware. And then that's had a huge impact on my whole life and everyone around me. And I think that's, it's such, again, like we said before, this stuff is simple. And it's so simple, it's just been sort of flung out and forgot about. And yet it's the most important stuff, because I think everyone, you know, there's a real belief now that you're not enough if you don't have a million followers, or you're not enough if you don't have the gold medal or the world title, or, you know, it's rubbish. I think you're enough as you are. Just do the work, be compassionate, and just, you know, every day you step out your house, say, you know, how can I make the world a better place today? And if people went out, and it's infectious, that, you know, that positive attitude, then obviously everyone's going to have a bad day. But it's also amazing if somebody's really nasty to you first thing in the morning, then your energy changes.
Takes it with you. Yeah, you take it with you, don't you? You know, even going, you know, you commute to work and, you know, someone cuts you up, someone, you know, doesn't say hello to you in the morning, like little things like that, or you turn your phone on straight away and it's negative. You know, the thing I do now is I write down every morning five things I'm grateful for. And I find that helps me so much. I have my cold shower, I do my breathing, it kind of relaxes me. And then I'll, you know, I won't switch my phone on for the first hour, because I just think, right, I want to get to work, you know, all good, you know, without anything affecting that. And I think those simple things, they really do work.
I know. And I think this is, you know, but you saying that there, people, I've said that to a lot of people, and people are like, well, I don't really have the time. I don't really want to do it. And then it's like, well, is it going to take a major car crash for you to go, oh, I need to start doing this? You know, what does it actually have to take? And it's funny, because everyone just gets pulled back to that base level again. And I always say to people that, you know, gratitude, if you're practicing gratitude, you generally can't be unhappy and grateful at the same time. And people are like, yeah, it doesn't really work, it's all a bit airy fairy. And I said, no, you got to write it down, write a journal. But it's not these things, you might not see a change. You're not going to notice a change. You're not going to lose 5 stone overnight, or have the car or whatever. These are like such inner changes that in a year or 2 years time, you'll be like, wow, I'm actually not getting so frustrated with things. And they're just little things. And, you know, same with the only audio stuff that's on my phone is audiobooks. And every day I tune into one of the most profound books I read was Eric Tolle's Power of Now.
Yeah.
And I always try to listen to a little bit of that each day. You know, if I'm driving out to the countryside to do my rides, I put on the podcast or I put on the audiobook and just listen to a little bit. And it always reminds me. And it also reinstates to me that I need to continually do this work, because if not, I'll just get pulled back to human doing, stress, and living in my head and not where my feet are. So I realized that this is stuff that you can't just do for a week and then everything's going to be changed. And I think that humans are so like that. We're a lot of people are dopamine searchers, you know, they want to seek out these rewards constantly. And if they don't get if they don't get to swim in the crystal water, then they just give up and they go back to their old habits. And I think that's a shame.
It's going for the quick fix, isn't it? Rather than the long, more sustainable one.
Yeah. And phones have programmed that into us. We want things really quickly. And, you know, and I always say to people, you know, they'll either make a diet change, then this change and that change, and they're all in their heads, they've read the next thing, you know, 6 minute abs, this minute, 3 minutes to a better life, all this stuff. And I think, you know, you just need to do the simple things and do them well. Mm-hmm. And you make small changes everywhere in your life. And then ultimately, eventually, you've built a strong foundation and you'll just start to see yourself manage things better. And even the fact that I brought up the guy on the bike shows that it's still imprinted in my head. Yeah. So if I'm living by the philosophy of what the power now tells me, then I shouldn't have even brought that up. So I even know myself that I can feel there's still an energy in me that's happened from that encounter. So I know there's still a lot of work for me to do internally, that as these things happen, they literally just, it's just a memory now. It's an electron in my brain. But yet by me bringing it up, I'm giving power to it.
Yeah. So, well, it's interesting that, you know, those things do stay with us. So to summarize this conversation then, what do you think is the best advice perhaps you've ever been given that you live by every day?
Stay in the moment. Literally stay in the moment. It's all we have.
Yeah. I think that's great advice. I really do, because it's so simple, but yet it's so effective, you know, and it starts with slowing everything down. It doesn't matter how busy you are. Take 2 minutes, slow it down,
stay in the moment. It's so easy to be pulled into your head, whether it's in a future that doesn't exist or in a past that's gone. You know, I think it's great to reflect, absolutely. And it's great to set goals and visualize. Absolutely. I'm not saying that, but ultimately the only place that anything is ever done is in the moment. So staying present, and that's possibly one of our biggest challenges as mankind.
Yeah, I agree. And especially the way life is now, like you said earlier, everything's on your phone, everything's so much easier, and it's easy to go into this virtual world where everything seems great and wonderful. But then, you know, I do what you do. The thing that makes me feel the most connected is going into the countryside, you know, going on these walks and just realizing, not in a negative way or anything, how insignificant all your problems are. You know, you'll go into these mountains and they're going to be there long after, you know, I go and other people go, and you just realize, you know what, it's all right, really, you know, just connect with that and it's going to be okay.
So how did, you know, do you not think that you've got to that point through self-awareness, through learning about your thoughts, your emotions, your own journey that's taking you there?
Yeah.
That's not something you've just woke up and thought, I'm going to go and do this.
Oh, it's taken me ages to get to that point. It's taken me through burnout. It's taken me through a nasty injury in rugby, which forced me to stop, you know, and it's a shame that it took me to that point of almost being the catalyst moment for me to start doing it rather than doing it all along. So my goal is to maybe create a podcast like this, or with my teaching, you know, show people that you can instill it all the way. It doesn't have to reach a big point that you can start doing this. It's so easy, but yeah.
I think that is just, you know, living for the moment and not, you know, of course, set the goals. You have to have things to drive you and those dreams and those visions and that mission, but ultimately just getting really into the now, getting curious about it and enjoying it. And then also knowing there will be rubbish days, there will be hard days, but what's your coping strategies around them? And I have four that I always fall back on. It's sport, connecting with people, creativity, and nature. And if I can get those four things in my life, then I know that I'm always on the right path.
Yeah. It's just about getting back to those good habits, because we're all going to have bad days. It's just about sticking to them, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's the same as a diet. You know, I think that you know, you can eat all the great foods, but it's okay sometimes just to go and have something that makes you feel good. I think that,
yeah,
you know, like enjoy life. You know, it's not, it's get out there enjoying it, because man, the day will come where you're in a hospital gown lying in bed 8 in ward 2 and you've pooed yourself, and you know the highlight of your day is having someone spoon feed you or nurse you or wash you. You know, that might be when you're 90, it might be when you're 80, and you know, it might happen, you know, sooner, who knows? We don't know what's in the future. Yeah. So it's not, you know, not living without regrets, you know, go and do things. And that's why I don't like the bucket list thing. You know, people are like, I've got a bucket list. Why would you do it? Why would you wait to do a bucket list? If those are the things that really enrich you and really love, do them now.
Yeah, no, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Make room for them. You know, it's, I remember speaking to people in hospital and the guy was saying to me, I had this big plan for retirement, all this different stuff. You know, he retired and 2 weeks later he got a brain tumor.
Yeah.
I was like, why? You know, like you worked your ass to the ground for like 20, 30 years to only get a brain tumor.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
in that time, you should have made time somewhere for your passions, whether that's get up an hour early in the morning or whatever, make time for your passions so you're not just living on that treadmill.
Yeah. And that's great advice, you know, tomorrow isn't owed, is it? You know, and that's, you know, people always say hope is a big thing because you hope you're going to wake up tomorrow. And, you know, you don't know. You've just got to enjoy your life. David, thank you so much for coming on, mate. Like, no, I've been so inspired by this conversation. And, you know, it alludes to what we said earlier about, you know, getting off your phone and having a conversation. It's rare now that people can actually have a conversation for an hour with no phones, no distractions, and how much you can get out of it. So I hope people listening can get as much as I know I certainly have about this conversation. So thank you for coming on, mate.
Tom, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for asking. And yeah, hopefully somewhere along this, we've shared a little bit of a wisdom tip that can change your life somewhere.
I'm sure it has. Thank you again.